Coming up, Justine got around to reading a previous guest's book and is thrilled she did. And Anne McMahon joins me as we talk about her 40-something cranky, foul-mouthed ex-Catholic protagonist. It doesn't get any better than that. I'm Brad Shreve, and this is Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Justine, what are your thoughts about Facebook?
You know, I really like Facebook. The stuff people complain about doesn't really affect me one way or another. And I've never been concerned about it going into my privacy or the like. And I love it. I live most of days on there, you know, and I'll have it running in the background.
And you don't really have any privacy in this world today anyway. But
well, that's what I always say.
Facebook pisses me off a lot with some of the things they do, but they actually did something cool last week.
Okay.
As of last week, you can start airing podcasts on Facebook.
Excellent.
It's on a Facebook page. You have to have a Facebook page to do it. Now, here's the deal. They sent out invitation only for people that can start it out. And we didn't have a Facebook page, so of course we didn't get an invitation.
Yes.
And secondly, they didn't send that many out anyway. And third, it was supposed to roll out last week, and it looks like it was a complete disaster.
Good to know.
Yes. That all being said, in fact, I talked to a couple of podcasts, and they said, we're going to wait and see what happens before we consider getting in on this. So it looks like they were good to wait a week. But because we want to be ahead of the game when it comes time for us to be able to get our podcast on Facebook so people can cruise through Facebook and listen to the show at the same time, we now have a Facebook page, and I will put a link in the show notes, and people can please go in and sign up, because I think the more people we have that like the page, the more likely we're going to get a invitation quicker than others.
Yes. With our new Facebook page, people can be more interactive. The listeners can actually talk to each other.
I would love that. I would love that. And start sharing what they think of your books and what they think of the guests. That would be wonderful. So
yes,
we're going to make it their page.
That's so right.
So what have you got going on? Did you read something this week?
Well, I did. And, you know, people who follow me on Facebook may have noticed that I'm really annoyed with Amazon, because when it suggests books for me to read, it doesn't take into account that it knows damn well which books I have bought, because when I click on it, it says, you bought this. And so the recommendations, I was thinking, you know, we've done how many shows now? 75. So I've read 75 mysteries, you know, which I've recommended. I've read more mysteries than that. And Facebook or Amazon just keeps recommending books I've already read. It says, here are books you might like. Well, I did like them. Pay attention, Amazon. Let's keep going.
You would think that would be an easy algorithm to build.
Yes, you would. And it would be to the benefit, because they're actually selling me books that I might buy.
Well, strangely enough, I get book recommendations that are my books.
You're not the only author I've heard that has that problem.
So I've been buying them so I can make money, but then I realized I'm not making money.
That's right. But, you know, so sometimes it takes a little bit of digging for me to find the book. And, you know, I'll mine various sources. And this week I mined our spreadsheet of guests and decided that Ellen Hart, who's been a guest on the show, I think she was on last September. I hadn't read any of her books. And I don't know quite how I made that omission. Because as you say in the show notes, she's the Agatha Christie of LGBT mysteries. And so, boy, I don't know where that just hits my sweet spot.
And actually, I'm not the one that said that. There are lots of reviewers that said that. So
that's, yeah.
That way, if somebody doesn't trust my judgment, there are other people they can trust their judgment.
Well, I trusted your judgment, not knowing that it was other people's judgment.
Well, there you go.
I picked up the first book in her Jane Lawless series, and it had been moved to Kindle in 2010. And as I was reading it, I thought, golly, when the heck was this written? And so it was originally written in 1989, And you can tell it's written in 1989 because nobody's got the internet. Nobody has cell phones. In fact, you know, nobody even discusses cell phones. There's a scene where the couple of the characters fall asleep in front of the television and then the national anthem comes on. And I would venture to say that about half of our listeners have no idea that the national anthem used to come on when they'd stop airing TV for the night. You know, when I was a kid, the only thing I ever wished for was 24-hour TV because I didn't want to see that national anthem. And I've certainly gotten more than I've wished for. But it was indeed written in 1989. The story itself holds up. The homophobia is much more prevalent in a book like that. Everybody, almost everybody, is either virulently homophobic and expresses it loudly or is quietly so, and then the people who support gay people will say so in just a small minor whisper. So that part, I think, took a little getting used to for me and transported me back into that era of the 80s. Against that backdrop, once I made that cultural shift, the book itself is very interesting. It's Ellen Hart, and it is the first in her Jane Lawless series. The title of the book is Hallowed Murder. And in it, Jane Lawless, who owns an English pub, which by all descriptions is the kind of place I would just love to visit. It's set in an old lodge, and it has a big bay window, and it serves things like steak and kidney pie. And you can sit there and play darts, or cribbage boards are set up on the table. And it just seems like the most welcoming spot that it is.
Is this pub in a small village in the English countryside?
It is not. It is modeled on a pub in the small village in the English countryside. However, the character Jane grew up in England and says there are hundreds of pubs in London and they're all different. So this is the kind of pub that she would like. It is set in Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. Well, I was way off. Okay.
You were way off. So it is the Midwestern take on a English pub, but it just sounds delightful. And she runs this pub. She's an alumna of the local university, and she is the alumna advisor to a sorority on campus. And a member of the sorority ends up dead. Jane and her friend Cordelia stumble upon the body. They're out with Jane's dogs, and Jane's dogs go nuts and find the body, and then Jane and her friend discover it, and Jane realizes that the victim is a young girl that she has known from the sorority. The police tend to write it off as a suicide. It's never clear to me whether the police really think it's a suicide or not, but most people think it's a suicide, and Jane is pretty certain that it isn't, and so she sets out to investigate it. And as with most amateur detectives, she, of course, ends up being put in danger herself. She comes up with a intricate plan to catch the killer, which goes horribly sidewise, and she's in danger in the Minnesota winter, which I find even more chilling than being in danger in, you know, good weather.
Well, Minnesota winter is dangerous in and of itself.
That's right. That's right. And when one is running from a killer, it is not a good place to be. She is very calm throughout. She's got a very gentle demeanor. She is always sensitive to the various young people, whether they're in sororities or they know the victim from other parts of her life. And she questions them, and when they refuse to go further or ask her to leave, she moves along politely, but she gathers the information and eventually figures out who she thinks is the killer, but she doesn't have enough to go through the police, and decides to use herself as bait. Always a bad idea in my book. You know, did Jessica Fletcher ever set out to use herself as bait, or did she end up getting just targeted by the killer?
She never had to worry about it because she was the killer.
Well, there is that. That is the non-canon way to look at Murder, She Wrote. But it's a marvelous book. Jane Lawless just seems like the kind of woman that you would want to know in real life. There's just the right mix of intrigue and this subtle undercurrent of danger. You don't know quite who's next. You don't know quite who to suspect. There's not an overtly evil person among the characters. So you're always wondering. The killer is, well, we all know that I never try to figure out these things. But it was a surprise to me. But once you put together all the facts, it should have been obvious. One of those things.
Yep. They played fair and you didn't get it.
They played fair and I didn't get it. Yes.
I love that.
Yeah, I love that too. I love that too. I would say that's probably the biggest standard that I have for a book, for a mystery. You played fair. All the clues, none of the clues are kind of left hanging. You don't say, well, that clue, you know, they never really tied that in, and it wasn't a red herring. Then the author just must have forgotten it on the table and didn't catch it when editing. No, everything in here is deliberately placed, and it's just a terrific book. She's won 5 Lambda Mystery Awards and well-deserved. Many more nominations and well-deserved.
5 Lammies, she must be pretty good.
Yes. Yes.
And she was delightful to talk to.
Yes. Yes, she was. Yes, she was. So it's an intriguing, it almost became a thrilling, but, you know, scene with the killer at the end is somewhat expected these days. And so I don't think it falls into my thrilling category. It is an intriguing mystery, and it gets my intriguing recommendation.
And you had something on your list you forgot to do. You were supposed to do a shout out.
This week we have a certain fan who put a lot of money into buy a cup of coffee. We want to let them know that we appreciate it. And they did not give us permission to use their name on air.
Actually, they did give their name. They put someone.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking maybe our listeners could narrow it down with that.
Well, yes. So go ahead. Talk about not having clues that'll lead you anywhere. Here's the mystery for this week. Who is the someone who gave us a lot of money in the cup of coffee?
All right. Coming up, I've got Ann McMahon. We had a lot of laughs. We had probably even more laughs when we weren't recording, but there were plenty of them in the show.
Sounds great. Sounds wonderful.
Enjoy it.
See you next week.
Please join our new Facebook page where you'll get updates about the show and we'll just talk about whatever comes up. Search for Queer Writers of Crime on Facebook or simply click the link in the show notes. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, Ann.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on, and I want to say great job on winning the 2020 Lambda Literary Award for Best Lesbian Mystery.
Thank you very much. I wanted to win the Pillsbury Bake Off, but I'll take the Lammy.
Oh, you have better chance of winning the Pillsbury Bake Off than I do, I can assure you. There's a reason why my husband does all the cooking.
Well, I guess that makes you a half-baked writer.
Well, yeah, people would tell you that's true.
Well, actually, I went up and looked at your books, and I thought they both looked great. I read all of the free samples that were available, and I guess I'm going to have to break down buy them.
I would love to hear what you think of them.
I'd be happy to share. I'm sure I'll love them.
And folks out there, I did not ask for the plug here.
So. He did too. He's lying.
Yeah, there's actually a contract. Every guest has to sign a waiver that they mentioned my book at least once.
At least once.
Well, I got to tell you, my guests come from many places here. They contact me through social media, emails. I get listeners that will send me emails or contact me on social media, and they say, you've got to get this person on the show. Sometimes I get emails from editors. And sometimes when I realize the show hasn't been as diverse as I want it to be, I reach out myself.
Right. Okay.
But you're on today because a certain person reached out to me and they said, you have got to get Ann McMahon on your show.
Was it my mother from the grave?
No, it's actually a person that you told me you stalk.
Oh, it's Michael. I only guessed correctly because he is the only person I stalk.
Okay.
So, I mean, since Jesse Norman died.
If you folks are wondering who she stalks, it's Michael Nava.
Michael Nava.
So, yeah, when Michael Nava sends me a message and says, you've got to have this person on your show, you know what? I listen.
Oh, that's so lovely. I mean, I'm surprised he did that after the restraining orders.
Oh, my goodness. You're so stoic.
I am, aren't I? It's tragic.
You know, and I want to tell you something. Despite Michael's recommendation, I did have some grave concerns about having you as a guest.
Uh-oh.
And we're going to get to that in just a minute after I do your formal introduction.
Okie dokie.
Okay. So here we go. Ann McMahon is the author of 12 novels and 2 collections of short stories. She is a 2-time Lambda Literary Award winner, a 9-time winner of Golden Crown Literary Society Awards, a 3-time IPP medalist, a Forward Indies finalist, and a recipient of the Alice B. Medal for her outstanding body of work. She resides in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, with her wife, Salem West, 2 precocious dogs, and an exhaustive supply of vacuum cleaner bags. That was pretty good since I can't find my glasses.
That was very good.
You've gotten quite a bit of attention based on that.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, and I even have an amendment. I'm now a Forward Indies winner. The announcements came out yesterday, and my novel, The Big Toe, actually did medal in its category.
Well, great job. Great job. As I think my listeners know, I never say congratulations because these aren't prizes. You work hard for them.
Yeah, that's very true.
So good job on that. And also, you know, I'm here in LA, and I want to say hi back to my home state of North Carolina.
I think that's incredible. I can't believe that you actually, what did you say? You're from the High Point area?
I'm from High Point, which used to be just a little distance from where you are in Winston-Salem.
20 miles, about 20 miles.
Now that the highways are open, they're practically neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my most recent book is a kind of a comic romp called The Big Toe, and it's about 2 women who inadvertently get temp jobs repossessing cars. And part of it actually takes place in High Point.
Well, I'm definitely going to read that one.
I think you'll get a kick out of it.
I say every week I'm going to put that on my list, but that one has got to be on the list. So definitely do it. And I doubt any of the listeners pay that much attention to me. But just in case they do, when I have a guest on from the Midwest, I say, oh, I grew up in the Midwest. And when I have a guest on that's from the South, I always say, oh, I grew up in the South. So the explanation is I grew up in elementary school in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And that I did a brief stop in Western Pennsylvania, where I knew you lived a short time as well.
Absolutely.
And then in middle school, I think they called it at the time, I moved to High Point, North Carolina. So sometimes I have a Midwestern accent and sometimes I have a Southern accent. It all kind of depends on who I'm talking to.
How about a Pennsylvania accent?
I don't know. Is there a Pennsylvania accent?
Well, I mean, if you watched Mayor of Easttown, you'll know there is.
Okay. Well, I only lived there for 2 years.
So. Oh, okay. Well, I grew up there. I grew up in northwestern Pennsylvania, not too far from Lake Erie.
Okay. You were quite a ways. I grew up, I was in Greensburg.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, you know what? People don't listen to this show to hear about me. I think they'd rather hear about you. So let me tell you what my concern is.
Okay.
My concern was, I knew there was this romance between Evan and Julia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was concerned, okay, we've got another romance here where a mystery is kind of shoved in to give it a little story. But then I thought, you know, Michael referred her to me. That wouldn't be mm-hmm. the case. Mm-hmm. So when I read the book, I learned very quickly, their relationship is very important, but hands down, without a doubt, this is a well-skilled political thriller.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Welcome to the show. You checked the boxes.
Yay!
We're mainly going to talk about Galileo,
okay,
which is the second novel in the Evan Reed series. Now,
correct.
I know Evan is short for Evangeline.
Evangeline.
Evangela, thank you. I knew I wasn't going to get that right. Is it still pronounced Evan?
It's still pronounced Evan. You don't remember having to read Evangeline and like in middle school, that horrible, that poem, that epic poem?
It doesn't ring a bell.
Oh, well, you probably blocked it out.
And I actually know Evangeline. It's just sometimes those things don't come out right. Mm-hmm. Well, the first in the series was Dust. So this is the second in the series. Mm-hmm. And first thing I want to ask you before we get into the title or before we get into the book, what is the meaning of the title?
The meaning of Galileo?
Yeah.
Well, Galileo, the meaning actually is part of the mystery that Evan has to solve while she's working this case. And it ends up being the name of a very, very exclusive, I'll say gentleman's club for lack of, you know, better description, but not gentleman's club in the sense of the kind of skeevy bar with naked dancers, but one of the really big old money society clubs, like, you know, the Harvard Club, or I forget the name of the other one that's really huge in DC, but you know what I'm talking about, where you have to pay a fortune to belong. And generally there are really strict requirements for family lineage, and the memberships are kind of passed down through generations. So Galileo actually is the name of this terribly exclusive club that becomes bound up in the mystery that Evan is hired to unravel.
I think it's funny you brought up gentlemen's club when it comes to strip clubs, because there's my husband and I drive past one pretty frequently, and we laugh at the fact that they call them gentlemen.
That they call it a gentleman's club, exactly.
But I'll tell you, the gentleman at Galileo, I don't really consider gentleman either.
Not so much.
No, no. Not so much, for sure. So let's talk about Evan.
Okay.
Tell us who she is.
Evan Reed is a kind of 40-something, cranky, foul-mouthed ex-Catholic who is a dustbuster by trade. She is a paid political operative who is hired by either side of the aisle to vet candidates for national office. So if a party is looking at running somebody for president, for example, which was the case in the first book, Dust, they will hire a person like Evan to dig into that person's background so they can find out every possible thing they might need to know and don't want to be surprised about down the road. So that's what she does. And she's very good at it. And in the course of her work, very often she uncovers things that the people who hire her would prefer not to know and would prefer to put in a drawer and forget about. So when Galileo opens, Evan is hired by an opposition. The president of the United States is going to nominate an ultra-conservative justice for a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And Evan is hired at literally the 11th hour to look into the background of this man who's already been widely vetted over the course of his career in a last-ditch effort to find anything they can get their hands on that might derail his nomination. So that's what her job is. And that leads her into this coterie of kind of very dark and seamy activity going on inside this exclusive club called Galileo. And it's also bound up with ritualized sexual abuse of children in the Roman Catholic Church.
I got to tell you, this whole thing with the Republicans trying to push a Supreme Court justice quickly into a seat reminded me of a certain somebody a few years ago. Did that happen to be an inspiration?
It was actually a really kind of quirky coincidence.
Oh, really? So it had nothing to do with Kavanaugh?
Yeah, Kavanaugh, because I had already been working on this book. And what actually got me interested in writing this one was when the grand jury report in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania about abuse in the Roman Catholic Church was released publicly, and it was on such an epic scale in all of these dioceses across the state that no one could really take it in, you know, how widespread the cases were. So that was what led me into the whole idea of writing the story. And I had decided to pick someone like a Supreme Court justice, and then all the Kavanaugh stuff just happened.
So you're a soothsayer.
Apparently. You should be very afraid.
Well, I got to tell you, Evan's job sounds wonderful. I'm nosy as hell. So yeah. I would absolutely love that job.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of like getting to be the ultimate voyeur in a way, right? Mm-hmm. She and her little quirky extras, you know, the kind of skeevy private eye with all the ex-wives and the woman named Ping who can crack into any computer system anywhere and actually does it from her kitchen table while she's baking. You know, I just love the dynamic between the three of them. And I think there's one of the really funny scenes in the book is when the three of them break into the accounting office to try to go through all of those records.
Well, I love that Ping was not the stereotype hacker that anyone would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. She's what, like a 72-year-old grandmother from Georgia?
And not another teen geek.
No, not at all.
So no stereotypes there.
No.
I have a question about Evan. She's sarcastic. She's wisecracking. She's smart ass. Mm-hmm. Yet she's lovable. I'm going to bring up my own book again. The protagonist in my book is Mitch. Mm-hmm. And he's very similar. He's a smart ass, wisecracking. And I get reviews or people that say the protagonist is a jerk. Why would I care or read about him? I don't understand why anybody would read this book. And then I'll get another comment that says, he is a wisecracking smartass, yet you understand why, and that makes him lovable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, if you're far more skilled than I am, but I'm curious if you've gotten the same kind of conflicting comments.
It's amazing. I got many more of those kinds of comments after the first book, Dust.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if by the second book, the people who just hated the character peeled off or whether, you know, whether I developed her character enough that they began to kind of, you know, look inside her a little bit more. Because I think Evan has a pretty rich interior life, particularly in Galileo. We learn a whole lot more about her childhood and the fact that her mother basically abandoned her when she was a teenager. And her best friend, Tim, is a Roman Catholic priest, and the two of them grew up, you know. So, I mean, I feel like, oh, also the fact that Evan is the mother of a teenage girl,
mm-hmm.
and I think is actually a very good mother. So what I try to do, which I'm sure is the same thing you did, is she has this really brash exterior, but she also has a whole lot of redeeming qualities that you kind of get to see.
Mm-hmm.
In how she lives her life and the things that really matter deeply to her.
Yeah, I definitely saw that. And I'm glad you brought up Tim, her childhood friend, Father Tim Donovan. And the reason I brought it up or wanted to bring it up is Evan is an ex-Catholic.
Right.
But she's kind of, I call her an ex-Catholic, but she's very conflicted. And I know quite a few people like that. It's kind of hard when you're in the Catholic Church to break away from that.
Yeah.
I go to a very liberal church, and the ex-Catholics that we have call themselves recovering Catholics.
I've heard that before. That's true.
What's interesting is the only other mystery or crime novelist that I can think of that has religion involved with their main character is Lev Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
His Nick Hoffman is Jewish. Now, his character does continue with his faith and practices Jewish traditions still. But why was it important to have the Catholic background with Evan and her conflict with that?
In religious themes are really pretty paramount in most of my books, even if they're subterranean. And I generally write characters who have conflicted relationships with God.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's kind of a manifestation of my own struggle. And the reason that I picked the Catholic Church, I wasn't raised Catholic, I'm not Catholic, but there are many things about the faith that appeal to me, particularly as a writer. I like the fact that in Catholicism, the concept of God is kind of distant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really personal. And there are a whole series of intercessors between us and him. So mm-hmm. all of these different filters we have to go through even to reach him. I like the fact that historically the church has been kind of dark and brooding and, you know, not always welcoming, and the, you know, a lot of the ways they do sacraments, particularly things like confession, are kind of medieval. So I like all the entrapments that go with that. So I feel like Catholicism works very well for me as a vehicle when I want to write about people who are really struggling with working out their relationships with God, you know, whatever that means. And Evan is a perfect example of that, because she's actually a person of really deep personal faith, but she's aware of the conflict that presents, you know, for her as a lesbian, for mm-hmm. one thing, being raised as a Catholic. And the fact that her closest relationship is with a priest, but very often the only time that she'll go to see him is at night in the confessional. And of course, he always knows who she is when she comes in. I just really like that. I like the way that little dichotomy plays out for her.
When you were describing the Catholic Church's way of distancing people from God, it reminds me of Rosalind Carter years ago when she was being interviewed. I don't know why in the world I remember this. Mm-hmm. But she said that she talks to Jesus because God is just too big of a deal for her to comprehend.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I'm not, even though I go to church, like I said, my church is very liberal. Probably about half the congregants are atheists. Mm-hmm. I'll explain that someday, but it is still a church.
Okay. Covered dish suppers must be a blast.
If anybody wants to look it up, I mean, Unitarian Universalist, go look it up online and you'll know what I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
I know what that is.
Okay, so there you go. We pretty much let everybody believe what they want to believe, and we just have common core beliefs of what is right and wrong. So.
Yeah, I remember that, you know, the comedian Kate Clinton, in one of her comedy routines, I always remember this. She talked about being a Unitarian, and she said, "I'm a Unitarian. I pray to the unit. So what?"
Well, actually, I can give a good explanation of what a Unitarian is. Thomas Jefferson was a Unitarian, and he rewrote the Bible, and he took all the miracles out.
There you go.
There's a good explanation. And we're like, well, how do you take all the miracles out? Well, you don't, you're left with just stories.
Well, you know, and it gave me like the particular plot of Galileo, since it concerns the sexual abuse of boys, sort of ritualized through the church, and Tim Donovan's unwitting involvement in that. The book is as much about Tim's conflict coming to terms with what he knew and stayed silent about, as it does with Evan's job trying to unravel this horrible backstory that may or may not be related to this judge. And then the way their two narratives come together toward the end is, you know, kind of what the book is all about.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought Tim up again, because I really enjoyed the character. Tell us more about Father Tim.
Well, Father Tim and Evan grew up as best friends in Southwest Philly in a terrible neighborhood, and took very different paths in life. Tim always knew that he was bound for a life in the church and was at peace with that and happy with it. And Evan, of course, went a different way. Tim basically became a priest in the parish where he grew up and has been very happy there. And then when the grand jury report came out and a lot of the abuses were exposed, it triggered memories of his that he had repressed from his own childhood, and things that he recalled as a young man participating in events at the parish school involving the priests, and how he understood in a different way that, you know, what he was actually witnessing, but he never told anyone about it. And of course, you know, when the book takes place, he's dealing with a tremendous amount of guilt. And it's actually through conversations with Tim that Evan ends up getting some of the clues that begin to unravel the whole puzzle for her of how the Galileo Club is actually involved with the church and with some of the priests in all of these things that had taken place years ago.
Child abuse, and I would say especially child sexual abuse, is a difficult subject.
Yes, it is.
Is there anything that you wouldn't touch in any of your novels?
You know, I don't think so, really. It was interesting because I worked with a wonderful editor on this book, a woman named Elizabeth Sims. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's a Lammy winner in mystery, too. And she's a fabulous writer and a sensational editor. And I always joke that, and I say this with love, that if you work with her, you need to invest in a good hemorrhoid cushion, you know, because she's very direct. And, you know, if she sees something that, you know, she'll call you out and tell you it's too precious. But it was interesting because without giving away what actually happens in the book, the character of Julia makes a really shocking and difficult discovery that affects her very deeply personally. And it's tied into this investigation of Evans. And there's a kind of a climactic scene where she flies to Paris and has a confrontation with her mother. And there's like an envelope full of photographs that she finds that end up kind of being the clue that Evan needs to crack all this stuff wide open. And when Elizabeth finished reading through the book, she approached me very, very carefully and asked me if there was any reason why I chose to never tell the reader what was in the photos, you know? Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth knows me well enough to understand that I'm a survivor of child sexual violence. I'm very open about that. I talk mm-hmm. about it. I don't conceal it. And she wanted to be real cautious about approaching me because I think she feared that maybe it was, you know, just too close or too difficult for me to write about. And that was why I decided not to include that scene. And I said, oh, no, you know, it wasn't that at all. I actually decided not to write it. And I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this because I was afraid it would be offensive to readers. I thought maybe that would be like a bridge too far. And I didn't want to make the book really graphic. I wanted to talk about the violence, but not kind of have it in your face.
Right.
So once I shared that with her, she kind of said, no, you have to write that. That scene has to be in there. There has to be a scene where Julia sits down and looks at those pictures. That has to happen. So I wrote it. So it's in there. I mean, I know that's a long-winded answer to your question, but at least where it concerns topics like that, you know, things that I myself has experienced, you know, no, there aren't things that I wouldn't write about.
I wouldn't say it's a long-winded answer because it was an important answer. And I know it must be difficult to be so open about your experience. At the same time, I think it's wonderful.
Thank you.
People need to hear it.
I agree with you. And I know that it's not always, particularly like I started out writing in the lesbian romance genre, and that would have been talk about a short career, you know, had I done that then. But, you know, I feel like I've had a really sort of a kind of thoughtful and intentional journey as a writer. And as I've kind of gone along, you know, I wrote like a series of books, and I'm actually pretty well known for writing humor. This is not a funny topic. But as I go along, I find more and more ways that I can try to carry my, you know, the readers I've managed to accumulate, that I can carry them along with me, and that together we can look at topics that are a little, you know, more difficult. And hopefully they'll trust me to take, you know, to make that journey with them.
I'm going to speak just from my own experience. I have bipolar disorder, and Carrie Fisher was very open. Oh. And she is my idol because she is the person who said, you know what, it's okay. It's what you got. You know, so I'm sure you are somebody's Carrie Fisher.
I don't know. I mean, that would be wonderful. You know, like if I can accomplish anything with my, whatever the word is, you know, my collection of works, whatever that ends up being, if I can do that, if I can help anyone who reads the books find the voice to be able to say, yeah, you know what, that happened to me too, and I'm not alone, and it's really okay to talk about it. You know, then I've done my job.
Yeah. And if you can do it in an entertaining way, that's fantastic.
Yeah. You know, and I've talked about this before, that for me, a lot of times writing when you're trying to tell a story like that on several tracks, you know, because there are parts of Galileo that are fun and amusing, you know, the kind of family dynamics between Evan and Tim and Julia and their little family dinners and all that kind of craziness. Oh, and her relationship with Dan, who's the biological father of her daughter, and his like little 20 something trophy wife. So I put all those little things in there. And I've often talked about the process of writing is like being a boxer, you know, where you're kind of dancing around the ring. And you sort of, you jab, and then you nail one, you know, and then you just lay one on them. And then you step back again and you dance a little more and you make these little jabs and then you hit them again. So for me, that's kind of the rhythm that you need to go for when you're trying to tell a really difficult story like this one. Like you cannot just pummel somebody endlessly. You know, you've got to give them some breathing space. You've got to go in, you've got to make your point, and then you've got to back off a little and you've got to make it a little easier. And then you can go back in again. So that's kind of what I try to do with storytelling. And that's what I particularly try to do in these Evan Reed books, because they're generally, well, I say generally, there are two of them, much more, they have much heavier content.
I felt like this was going to be a really dark novel. That's what I was prepared for based on what I had read. And it was at parts for sure, but nothing to the degree that I expected. There were times I laughed.
Yeah, good.
You had quite a few touches of humor. And I find that common in thrillers, really most crime fiction. And for those that, let's say you don't read thriller novels, I'll use the Avengers as an example. If you watch the Avengers during the tensest moments of the movies, there'll be a joke in there. Either somebody does something funny or says something funny. Mm-hmm. And another example that comes to mind is Steel Magnolias.
Oh yeah, perfect one.
Funniest laugh in the entire movie is that scene where we have distraught Sally Fields in the cemetery grieving about her daughter. And then, boom, I don't remember who said Olympia Dukakis. Yes, it's a huge laugh. Describe more why that's important. You said it gives people a breather, but why is that important to have that in there?
Well, I think for that reason, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's because I grew up as the child of an alcoholic and I was the middle child, you know, so I always understood my role in the family to be the comedian. You know, I was the person who could walk into the middle of a brutal knockdown drag-out fight between my parents and distract them, you know, by doing something hilarious. It didn't always work, but, you know, when it worked really great and it calmed stuff down and it gave people a chance to sort of back away from the drama, you know. So, I mean, I think that's an important tool in literature. You have to do that. Otherwise, people aren't going to trust you. And I want them to trust me. I want them to, well, it's like there's a part in Galileo, I think, where at the beginning of the book where Evan and Tim are out in the snow and they're waiting for the Aurora Borealis, and she can tell that he's really upset about something. And she says, you look just like you used to look when we were kids. And I would drag you out of the neighborhood into a really scary part of town. And you were always afraid I was going to drop your hand and leave you there. Mm-hmm. And Tim says, but you never did. You always brought me back home. And that's what I think my responsibility as an author is. I've got to hang on to the reader's hand, and I have to make sure they know that I'm not going to leave them in an awful place.
That explains it very well. That takes skill.
Or a lot of damage.
Maybe a little both.
Yeah.
Now I want to go back to Julia. Is her last name pronounced Don?
Dunn, like Dunn. The poet John Dunn.
Okay. Julia Dunn, who is the other half of the romance between Evan and Julia. Mm-hmm. Tell us about her.
Well, Julia and Evan meets Julia in Dust in the first book. She's actually working on a case vetting a junior senator from Delaware who the DNC is thinking of running for president. So she is hired to vet him. And while digging, Julia Dunn is his wife, and they have a bi cam roll relationship. He lives in Washington. She lives in New York City and runs this publishing house. They have no children. And Evan begins to uncover some very unsavory things in the husband and Andy. Andy Townsend is his name, in his background. And then in the process of doing her research, she meets Julia because she has to go to New York and interview her. And the two of them have this kind of automatic chemistry, and there's a clear attraction there, and becomes a profound conflict of interest for Evan. But Julia is a very kind of patrician, more reserved, more sort of emotionally closed off kind of person. So she and Evan are quite different, but their relationship kind of uncomfortably develops throughout the course of Dust, which ends in a real kind of calamitous event at the end. And then their relationship continues in Galileo. Julia is the heir to a very prestigious publishing house, one of the oldest ones in the country, that had been run for generations by men in her family. And she's the only child. Her parents only had one child, a daughter. And so she accedes to that position and has taken the company over. So that's kind of who she is. And she has had off and on a difficult relationship with this third person who kind of dips in and out of all of their lives, this woman named Maya Jindal. And we're not really sure what in the hell is going on with her. Mm-hmm. We just know that she's kind of a for hire, probably into kind of black ops, and is often hired by people to come in and clean up bad situations. So there's this sort of triangulation between these three women who all have overlapping and odd relationship connections. So we learn a little bit more about Galileo.
And let's get into that a little bit. I want to tell you, I am normally not a fan of switching point of views.
Oh, okay.
It's one thing that drives me crazy, but I got to tell you, in Galileo, it works.
Oh, thanks.
What did you have? Was it four different points of view?
Four. I had four, yeah. Which for me is almost none. I'm not kidding.
Really?
Yeah, most of my books are like, you would think that I have, I know we don't use that term anymore, but a dissociative disorder. Mm-hmm. Because generally in my books, I'll have 10 different points of view. I have written books only in the first person also, but generally I'll have, you know, 6-8 different narrators who trade off telling different parts of the story. And I find that that really pushes me, you know, and I hope that I'm glad to hear you say that it worked in Galileo, you know, because I certainly wouldn't want that to be cumbersome.
Describing those other novels, normally that would like, I would be like, oh no.
Yeah, I'm not reading that. Yeah.
But I trust you based on what I read here.
Well, thank you very much.
How difficult is it to do those different points of view?
It is difficult because you have to really know the characters. You have to understand how they think, how they talk, how they're going to view events, and which ones of them are reliable and which ones really aren't. You know, and of course, the most important voice in Galileo is Evans, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think that we learn things about her that we can't know from her through these other people. You know, what we learned about Evan through Tim, for example, is unimpeachable.
Having to know these characters and to be able to write them from each of their point of views. Are you one of those authors that for yourself writes about each character and goes deep into their background?
Yeah, I am an outliner. I do map everything out pretty carefully so that when I sit down to write, I have a very clear idea. I know how many chapters a book is going to have. I know how many scenes are going to be in a chapter, and I know who the narrators of the scenes will be. And I track that as I go along so that I can follow the individual narratives, you know, as they move through the story and hopefully make sense. And then if I'm really lucky and I've done my work right, all of those narratives come together at the end in a way that makes sense.
Beyond the book itself, do you lay out their lifestyle for your own purpose? so that you understand what makes them tick.
Yeah, I do. I try to. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is, you know, I always like scoff at I don't even know why I'm saying that, you know, at people who talk about, you know, their muse and, you know, how they don't really know what's going to happen in their book until they're in the middle of writing it. And then it comes to them, you know, that kind of thing. But having said that, and having tried to be real intentional about plotting things out and knowing on the front what I'm going to be writing, you know, the day I sit down at the computer, you do have to allow for those things that just come to you, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Like things that you could not have anticipated until you put somebody into a situation and then they do something, you know, that you didn't count on or you didn't script, but it suddenly makes sense. You know, and you're a writer. I mean, you know that happens. And when it does happen, it's usually really great. And it's not something that you ever could have come up with in the abstract.
Yes.
Like until you get them in that moment and then they do what they do.
And it's a wonderful feeling.
It is a wonderful feeling. Like that scene in the parking garage where Maya just caps that guy because he broke the heel of her shoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't plan that, you know, but I'm like, yeah, this is exactly what she would, it would piss her off. She would do this.
Yeah. In my first novel, I put it on pre-order and then I all of a sudden wrote 5 new chapters.
Yep.
And my editor was beside herself. But when all was said and done, she said, those were the best chapters in the novel.
Well, what did that teach you?
Just let it speak to you.
Yeah.
Don't try to control it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I still think that you have a responsibility going into it, you know,
yes.
To know, you know, Salem and I talk about this all the time. And what we refer to, like our definition of storytelling is like putting up a tent, you know, when you go camping and you try to put a tent up and you know what a cluster that always is. But a tent basically is a big piece of canvas draped over a series of metal poles, right? Mm-hmm. So storytelling is like that. And you have these poles that support the story. And your job is to write from pole to pole to pole, because those are the things that prop the book up. Now, anything can happen while you're going from this pole to this pole, but you have to know where you're going to end up and where the story is when you get to that place. So for me, as long as I go into it knowing what all the tall poles are, I have the latitude while I'm going between one and the next, you know, to kind of stop and look at something else that I might not have planned on, mm-hmm. as long as I end up where I'm supposed to be.
And because of those, let's say, epiphanies,
yeah,
I have the background story written for my main character, right down to where he was born, what city he grew up in. I actually know the exact neighborhood and address where he grew and zoomed in on it in Google Maps. I have not shared any of that with the readers because it hasn't been important to the story. And I think someday it may become important, and that place that's in my head will not be the place that is important.
Right. I know exactly what you're talking about. But you know what? The fact that you do know that, the fact that you know all that granular detail, I know that comes out in the way you write those characters. It has to. I mean, it has to.
Yeah, I definitely think it does.
It might even come out in ways like the kind of food they like. What kind of music do they listen to? You know, where do they like to go on vacation? All of those things. What's their favorite color? How do they dress?
Yeah, exactly. But I keep it to myself because there could become a story where all of a sudden, for some reason, my character, to fit the story, I need to say he grew up in Bora Bora.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So that you have to change your mind.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I get it.
Because like you, I outline, but what I end up with at the end is sometimes not very close to what was in the beginning.
I've had where I've been writing a book that I've planned and outlined and, you know, I'm 3/4 of the way through it. And then something, well, I'd give you a perfect example. I was writing this novel called Beowulf for Cretans. That's about a woman who teaches freshman English in a small college in the Northeast. And she's writing a dissertation, you know, she's like trying to get tenure, and she's writing a novel. She's got like this little novel, her great American novel, you know, that she works on and all this kind of stuff. And the subject of her novel is all based on the theft of this this painting, this Willem de Kooning painting that was a real painting that was stolen mm-hmm. from the Arizona Museum of Art like 25 years ago and never found. So the novel that she's writing is based on an imagined life of the character in this painting. It was all great. Perfectly worked out, all scripted. Mm-hmm. I was 3/4 of the way through with book, and they found the damn painting. I'm like, you have got to be, I could not believe it. It was like the whole part of the book just exploded. And suddenly I had to figure that crap out. Like, what am I going to do about, you know? So yeah, you're wise. You're wise to be able to change stuff.
When we were talking, as we were trying to get the sound system here to work.
Yeah.
You mentioned that one thing you really like on this show is awkward questions authors get.
That didn't mean I wanted one.
Well, it means you're getting one.
Oh, no. I hope it's about fashion.
I'll have to think about it. I don't know if I have anything about fashion.
No, well, you know, you need some.
So hang on and we'll spin all the wheel. Right. Here we go. Okay. Are you ready for your question?
I've got something to bite. Okay.
Okay. I don't know where you'll go with this one.
Okay.
The question is, when are you going to write a story set in Philadelphia?
Didn't I just do that? I mean, Galileo is set in Philadelphia.
I know. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Is that really a question?
Yes. Yeah, so somebody was asked that.
Oh my goodness. I'll answer it. Maybe when are you going to write another book set in Philadelphia?
Or why do you choose Philadelphia?
You know, because I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I know it. You know, I for many years I lived in northwestern Pennsylvania, but then later in life I lived for 10 years in northern Delaware, which is right there near Philly. So, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Philly. My favorite aunt lived in Philly. I used to go up on the bus all the time. Right now, my best friend lives in Philadelphia. So I know the city and I love it. You know, I love everything about it. I love how old it is. I love how beat up it is. I love how dirty it is. But I just love it. I think it's incredibly textured and rich and a great place to set a story.
Well, before I let you go, I've got a couple questions. You said there's another Evan novel coming, and you also told me that you are working on, or you completed a cozy.
I did. I actually just did.
When can we expect those?
Well, the cozy is with my editor right now, and I think the earliest that one will see the light of day probably be maybe the fall of 2022. I think that's right. That would be the earliest. Mm-hmm. That one's fun. It's called Dead Letters from Paradise. So I'm very excited about it. It's a very different book for me.
Well, it's quite a change.
Yeah, quite a change. And it's also historical. It's set in 1960. So that was different too. But you know what? And boy, did that piss me off to have to confront the fact that 1960 is considered historical. So there was that, and then the next book I'm going to work on is the third Evan Reed book.
Somebody pointed out one day, if Happy Days came on the air today mm-hmm. and they went back in the past like they did on the original series, you probably would be looking at a show taking place in the 1990s.
Probably.
It puts things into perspective. Like,
it really does.
And it makes me feel old is what it does.
Yeah, it makes me feel like a fossil.
Okay, well, this has been Anne McMahon, and who I've had a delightful conversation with. And she has two novels in her Evan Reed series of thrillers. And the latest, which we discussed mostly, was Galileo. And thank you, Anne. It has been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Brad. You've just been delightful. And I still want that shirt.
She can see a picture of my shirt and maybe I'll send it to you.
Thank you. I'd love it.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.